Fred Film Radio, I'm Matt Micucci from the 68th edition of the Cannes Film Festival, joined by Joachim Trier, director of Louder Than Bombs, in competition here at the festival. Joachim, why did you decide to make this film in English?
Well, actually, further back, I studied in the UK at National Film and TV School. So there wasn't really a film school in Norway when I started out. I made a lot of short films in English. Then I went and did two Norwegian films, and the first of those, Reprise, got a lot of attention in the U.S., got distributed by Miramax, and then I did the obligatory round to Los Angeles and read 100 scripts almost or something. I actually read them at home. I didn't stay there all throughout. But, you know, and none of them felt sort of like they could become my personal project, so I decided to write with my co-writer, Eskil Fucht, an American movie. And that turned into Louder Than Bombs, and that took us altogether 6 years. And I made my previous film, Oslo, August 31st, in the middle of the process, just to do another movie, actually. So this, but we rewrote it several times as we got older. My co-writer, he didn't have children when we began, and now he has two. So obviously, like, we changed as we live with this project, huh?
The character of the writer, too, is kind of similar to the character of the other priest. There's always an element of writing in both of them. Is that something that interests you, character-wise, story-wise, even in language, too?
Yeah, I care, but I think in a film like Louder Than Bombs, the idea that to deal with grief, you have to reevaluate your story, and through telling each other stories, we figure out how to cope with life, and that in a film which is so much about the lack of communication, I think somehow that to have a young character like Conrad, for example, to be that sort of narrative driving force towards the end with his own rather romantic notions of storytelling, it was an interesting take on it. I think this film, again, is also very much about ambition and individuality, but put into a family context. And it's a sort of a tragic tale of that, but somehow I feel at least that this film is optimistic, ultimately. I think there is a way forward. It's very scary to reevaluate, like we are in a family, reevaluate our history and our memories, because it destabilizes our perception of ourselves. But that's also the only way out of grief, I believe, isn't it? I mean, like when Conrad understands that basic notion that in a childhood memory of playing hide and seek, his mother must have seen him, and maybe she thought it was fun to play too. That's a revelation. And that's how we restructure our ideas of our past. So that's an optimistic notion as well. That was my point, I guess. Yeah.
So how did you meet Isabelle Huppert?
I met her at the Isabelle Huppert at the Stockholm Film Festival. She was, one of my favorite actors of all time. We met there because we both won awards, and I was honored that she wanted to see my movies, and we stayed in touch. She was very generous, and so it turned out like we were doing a New York movie, and it's very natural to have a French board photographer be connected to an agency, you know, like Magnum or Seven or something in New York. So, hey, we could cast her, actually. And I asked her, and she was great about it. But I was a little bit spoiled there. I also had Gabriel Byrne, also had Jesse Eisenberg, and Dave Strathairn, and Amy Ryan. And then we found Devin Druid, who I also just wanted to film all the time. So, yeah, now I've jokingly said that we're trying with this film to steal the character drama back from the HBO TV series and put it on the big screen. But, yeah, sure, we're trying to take a 10-liter bottle and pour it on a pint glass here a little.
You mentioned before a little bit about the actual structure and the way you wrote the script, but while you watch the film, there's a lot of changes in style in terms of cinematography as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious to know more about how the whole thing is structured before you start filming it. Or is there any moments where you just go impulsively and, you know, so you get an idea in your head in the middle of shooting, you go like, oh, let's go with that?
Yeah, I try to stay intuitive because mise-en-scène is the most personal thing you have as a filmmaker. There are two different ways of looking at it. On one level, it's shot on 35, and we're very concerned with a specific look and feel to the general narrative. But then we throw in images, paintings, video games, YouTube clips, which I think is just a modern, hopefully a modern way of showing the how reality percolates in our mind with an overload of images. So no, it's a mixture of plan and spontaneity. Yeah, like really.
And you said that the film was shot on film. Mm-hmm. What difference does it make to actually shoot? The color and the texture obviously is very important then for in terms of
it looks different, it feels different.
Yeah.
We're going for neutrals, clear white colors, good skin tones.
Yeah, really shows in the close-up of his pair.
Absolutely, that's a
and
good example.
The rhythm too is very important in the film. There's moments where like it goes really fast, and all of a sudden it just stops. Like that moment with the close-up works wonderfully well.
Yeah, no, I like the dynamic of pacing in film. It's one of the main tools we have. Yeah. That, and I think also the interplay of objective and subjective point of view that we completely play with all the time in a movie. And in a movie like this particularly, where we want to go close to the skin and be close to them and be intimate and then go far away and see them perceived from someone else. And that sort of interplay is interesting. And it's, I feel that that's quite unique with cinematic. You can't quite do the same thing in a book or in a stage play.
Yeah, totally. And I have this theory where that like if you shoot on film, you're actually kind of more aware and sensible to the rhythm of the film. I don't know if you agree with that.
I don't know if that's true, but I know that the shooting changes because you load your magazines.
Yeah.
And you care, and the sense, I grew up on film sets because I come from a film family background, and you hear the ticking of the celluloid and all that stuff. It's very concentrated. Today, a lot of directors just turn on the camera and it runs even over lunch, you know, just always running.
You have to wait for the rushes to get developed too, so that adds tension.
That's true. We were speaking of Woody Allen, Steven Spielberg, Woody Allen, and myself. I spoke to Darius Conji the other day because I know him, and we were shooting almost parallel in New York, and when we pulled out of Deluxe, the lab, it closed down, so it's not around anymore. So that's sad.
Can you elaborate on the element of war reporting?
I think I'm doing fascinated with war reporting. I think also reading, there's a Susan Sontag book called Regarding the Pain of Others, which deals with how the traditional representation of other people suffering in painting and photography and how what the moral questions regarding that, which I found kind of relevant in terms of storytelling. There's something going on about both in journalism, about the tabloid expectations for clear truths that is also imposed on my media. The idea of single-handed narratives like has a very clear point of view, so they can be pitchable and sold and give people the expected. It's a general sense of the threat of complexity in narrative at the moment. So I don't know, and I think war photography is, can at its best be fantastic. At the same time, we're getting all these immediate news links that seems smart and conveying things, but how does that change our perception of things we are often not dealing with after all anyway? I mean, it's a difficult area, and I thought just it was interesting.
Thanks very much, and this is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.